We're going to proceed out of order. There are apparently people here to participate in item 18.01, Career and Technical Education Update. And so we're only a couple items behind.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Yes.
Thank you.
Dr. Ass.
I'm going to turn this over to Gretchen Morgan in a minute. We have Dr. Dale McCall with us today and Dr. Sarah Heath. We appreciate both of them being here to give us an update on career and tech ed in regard to our graduation guidelines as well as a general update. And we also have with us a very exciting demonstration of a program in Peyton that Dr. Flores has asked us to highlight some of these programs, and we're very excited to have that here today, too. So I'll turn it over to Ms. Morgan.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as Dr. Ass just summarized, we have sort of a two-parter in this agenda item. And so first I'm going to invite Dr. Sarah Heath and Dr. Dale McCall to share a little bit about career tech ed in general and then also what they've determined in sort of reviewing the overlap between career tech ed and graduation guidelines. So I'll leave it to you, too.
Thank you, Board, for having us, and thank you for your interest in career and technical education. So career and technical education is contextualizing academic content to meet technical skills attainment that meet high-wage, high-skill, high-demand jobs here within Colorado. And within our career and technical education content areas, we partner with our workforce development centers to make sure that we're addressing the needs of local regions. And just to give you a little bit of an idea of some of our requirements. So our content standards are aligned to industry needs, which relate directly to industry certifications, as well as to post-secondary attainment. We also have articulation and concurrent enrollment course alignment as part of the requirement for a program so that we can see the progression from middle school, secondary, and then also our post-secondary programs to ensure a quality plan of study. We have business and industry advisory committees, and they're required to meet a minimum of 2 times a year, and they reflect the direct content that's being taught in the coursework. So we have a list of program areas, too, that I'll share with you shortly. And we also require student leadership development, and that's formed with our career tech student organizations. And most people are really familiar with our groups like the National FFA, DECA, FBLA, FCCLA, those student groups that perform the leadership development that students also need for their post-secondary workforce readiness skills. We also require a plan of study, and that outlines the coursework that leads to a degree or directly into employment. And that also ties in different experiences such as work-based learning. And within the work-based learning components, those are required to be approved by the advisory committee as well, so that there's that local flavor on the actual program to make sure that it's leading to something directly for a student, either within their community or their region as a whole. So we do have some different cluster areas. Yes, that'd be wonderful. And as we have those maps coming around, you're going to see that we follow a national model of our career cluster areas, and these are actually directly from Department of Labor and some different partnerships we have. So within Colorado, we kind of bucket some different things together, and on the colorful side, that gives you the list of all of our program areas, and then we'll talk a little bit about data, which is on the back. So within Colorado, we have sector areas, so you'll see business, marketing, and public administration as one of the red area. And then we have our agriculture, natural resources, and energy, STEM arts and IT, skilled trades and technical sciences, health science, criminal justice, and public safety, and then our hospitality, human services, and education, all while working with our partners here at the Department of Education for our post-secondary workforce readiness, which is embedded in all of our programs, which is why it's in the middle. And so with each one of those content areas, we have middle school programming and high school programming that leads to our two-year programming at the community colleges, as well as our local district colleges. And that is what is on the backside, is just some little information for you about the actual enrollments of the programs. So you'll see, and the way we report is that we have students that could be in a program for more than one course. So that's why in the parentheses you have individual students, because that's our unduplicated count. So that's the difference there for you, just to have kind of a visual. And so you can see we had a little over 13,000 students in middle level participate in 13-14. And then we had a little over 96,000 individual high school students participate, which then lead into our post-secondary programs, which we have about a third of students enrolled in community college in a CTE program, which either leads to a certificate or applied science associate's degree. And then within our programs, we really do maintain our connection to business and industry, as well as our connection to contextualizing academic standards. And we do have some great exemplars of programs, which you'll hear from one today. But we also do a requirement to approve programs. And all of those different requirements I read out about the actual academic standards being embedded and the working with business and industry, those requirements for approved programs must exist to receive our categorical funding. And so in 1971 is when the categorical began, and that was really to offset costs for programs, just because I'm sure that you know equipment and supplies are rather expensive for CTE programs, especially things like automotive, dental assisting, things of that nature. And so in the 70s it began, and right now we reimburse districts so they prove expense, and then we give them the categorical after the fact. And right now it's reimbursed at about a 25% rate. So they report all their expenses and they receive 25% of what they spent back to the school and the school district. And then with our locally, they decide how that's allocated. We do have too, just in case you're interested of where some programs are located. I should have given this to you before I started. We do have an example of healthcare science primarily, just so you can see, and we can get this for any program that you'd be interested in, but just for the sake of time, we stuck with one. And with healthcare being such a growing field and industry here in Colorado, we thought this would be of interest to you. So it in the back, it gives you a map of Colorado and a breakdown of where all of our courses are located, all of our programs. And you'll see that the blue are the community college programs, and then the white are where the high school programs currently exist. We're working really hard to try to work on middle-level programming, but with a lot of HIPAA rules and different things like that, we're trying to just get them some basic experiences at this point to work into our programming. So that's where the programs exist. And then on the inside, also delineated by the color of the state, you'll see exactly what high school it is and then what their actual program is. So whether it's healthcare science, biomedical technology, dental assisting, different things with Project Lead the Way, foundations, and then also nursing. So you can see those differences in the programs. We do allow school districts and colleges to decide based on their local needs what program within a larger area. So within healthcare, what meets the needs of their local community. So that is a super broad, super large overview of career and technical education. More than happy to answer any questions that you have or any follow-up later. And then I'm going to turn it over to Dr. McCall.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairman, members of the board, I'm pleased to be here. We had an opportunity, Michelle Murphy and I, with Michelle with the Rural Alliance, and I had an opportunity to meet with Dr. Aspen, Gretchen, and others initially and talk about a concern we had at that time about where does career and technical education really fit into the menu of options. And I was not certain we were there, but I've learned that we are. And so that's good. We're working with the staff and have been they've been real responsive to clarify how career and tech education fits into at least two of the menu of options, the capstone program and the industry certificate. And being an old career and tech educator, I was interpreting some of those far too narrowly. And so my questions have been answered. As an example, industry certificate, I was under the old idea that those were only applicable to a couple of those career cluster areas that Sarah talked about, and they're really not. They're applicable to all of the various career areas. And our interest, Michelle and I, was to ensure that school districts and individual students and parents understood that how career and tech ed would fit into the menu of options and how it would work to meet some of the graduation requirements. And I just want to say one quick thing about this whole area, and this hasn't changed. Years ago, I was executive director of the State Council for Vocational Education. That was in the 90s. And at that time, the new and replacement jobs, the requirements for new and replacement jobs was around 65% of those, 65 to 70% required less than a four-year bachelor's degree. And, you know, that hasn't really changed. The thing that has changed is that within that category, there's still about 25% of the new and replacement jobs require an actual bachelor's degree or higher. But of the 65 to 70, 75% or so, what's happened there in career and tech ed fills a vital role is that those, you need a high school diploma plus some training beyond that, either a certificate or an associate degree. So these programs are very, very important. And our interest was, Michelle and I and others in the field, was to ensure that high school students in career and tech ed had the opportunity and made sure that they understood and the parents did and that we were communicating how these programs could fit into that. We also know fit in and they would get some credit some way in graduation guidelines for the work they'd done in that area. And I do think we have one document to pass out on the okay. They have it already? I think that college and career readiness demonstration sheet that you have really helped me understand how that fits in and works. And so I'm pleased with the work that's being done, and we'll continue to work with CD staff on this issue. But I'm comfortable that the district capstone program and the industry certification will work for career and tech ed students.
Thank you, Dr. McCall. Any questions? Yes, Dr. Schroeder.
Well, the concurrent enrollment, I would think also.
Yes.
So that would be a third one.
Yeah, you're correct. Yeah. Okay. Not all current tech ed programs are concurrent enrollment, but a number of them are.
Right.
So
that's actually three potential areas. I'm curious as I look at this and I look at this. Well, I'm both curious and I'm frustrated because I see parts of Colorado that are kind of not so many opportunities. But what concerns me is whether community colleges and or school districts have the resources to have a manufacturing facility that uses robots or a medical training area that actually has the equipment that students are going to. In other words, it seems to me that the high expense that's been a part of career and technological education has probably gotten more expensive. Is that just my brain not working? Or how do kids get hands-on in those particular areas where there is a lot of equipment, not just a laptop, but genuine equipment that they need to be using?
We are fortunate in that the way that we kind of structure purchasing agreements for the different districts kind of allows outside of boundary lines to come together to make things more cost effective with some state kind of guidance on that. And then we also reach out, we work really closely with the BOCES in the form of a consortium. One thing that I only mentioned our state funding. We do also have federal funding for programs, and that's through our Carl Perkins Act. Sure. And that is a formula-level grant, but it also offsets what most people use their Perkins funding for is professional development, equipment, and then FTE for teachers that are hard to find and hard to place within certain districts as well. And so we do have a lot of opportunity. We have great partnerships also with a lot of our nonprofit organizations that do supply a lot of that technology that we need. And then what's really great about the advisory committees is that most of them also produce some of their used equipment that is out of warranty but is still great for students to learn on because it's actually just a year older than what we would purchase them anyway. And that's been some great partnerships.
Okay.
Dr. Schroeder.
Do you see a shortage or...
In educators or in
money?
Equipment.
In the kind of equipment. Kids like hands-on stuff. They don't want to get the...
Right. I see on several visits to some of our most rural schools that they do have access to some quality, especially there's with robotics in particular, that cost has come down substantially, and there's a lot that can be done through iPads, iPhones, and things like that too that used to take up a whole space of either like logistical equipment.
Factory, yeah.
Exactly. Now it's scaled back, it's more compact. And then, too, working with manufacturing, a lot, again, a lot of our wonderful sector partnerships through our workforce development centers are really demonstrating, allowing students to job shadow and do a lot of those different things that maybe we can't provide physically on site at the high school. Then we also have designated career tech centers where lots of students can come together that offset the cost for districts where they provide it on one location and then have multi-scheduling for students to get them
That's great. Those classes. Thank you.
Dr. Schroeder, just quickly, many of the secondary programs, there is a provision in the career and tech ed law that says you can contract with a community college or another. So that's what happens. When you see, it's always a challenge, the equipment costs for these high-tech kinds of programs, but at least they can come together through a community college or an area, what are technical colleges, I think they're called now, and then the school district can contract with that agency and send students there. That happens throughout the state, but again, that equipment cost is very it's a problem.
It is, but on the other hand, kids do like to touch it.
You bet.
And get their hands dirty or whatever. Thank you.
Dr. Flores?
I just wanted to ask about small businesses that might, how does that work? I mean, I look at these areas that don't have anything, and I'm thinking maybe a farm, a business, you know, could.
Right. Definitely. And two, just to clarify, since for the sake of time, we only gave you healthcare. And so healthcare is one that we're trying to expand. And so, so if you wanted for a different, business education and family consumer science are pretty much in every single one of the districts or run through the BOCES. So this is just healthcare because this is one of our target areas for growth and improvement. So I did want to demonstrate that this is where addressing a significant need in Colorado and looking for
nationally.
People to help to help us spread the word that we're trying to grow programming as well.
Gotcha. Sorry,
Thank you.
That was my misinterpretation.
I'm glad I asked that. I'm glad I asked that question.
Further questions from the board? Very good. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For your presentation. I think it was very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Yes. So now I want to introduce to you Tim Kistler, who's going to be coming up here. You can come out of seat or be there, wherever you'd like.
I'd rather stand up.
Then you can stand up. And Tim's going to talk to us about a program that they have going in Peyton, which is an industry partnership program. This is in response to the request from you, Dr. Flores, to have some of these programs come periodically, maybe quarterly, just to be able to hear a little bit more about what's happening in this space. So I'm going to let Tim speak to his program.
Can I add one thing, Mr. Chair?
Sure.
I just want to add one point of introduction. I was at a Colorado BOCES meeting, or a Colorado Rural Council meeting, actually, it was, where Tim presented to the group, and the excitement in this program made me want to go out and visit, and I haven't had a chance to schedule that yet, but so we're excited to have Tim here. I think you'll really be amazed at some of the work that's going on.
Commissioner Board, thank you very much for having me, allowing me here. If I can introduce my wife, she came all the way up here for me, but support. I guess I'm sounding a little nervous, Lisa.
Make sure he's got his thing on.
Anyway, we had an opportunity in Peyton, and if none of you know where Peyton is, it's really the first rural school north.
I need to turn it on. Okay, so if I start getting too loud, please let me know because I'll start ramping up here in a second. But we're the first rural school north and east of Colorado Springs. Highway 24, you zip through Falcon, you make a turn in the road, that's us. Okay, then it's Calhan, Simla. Anyways, I had an opportunity. We have over 70% of our students going to college and or going to the military out of graduation. But my board, five entrepreneurs, continue to say we needed some type of vocational education. We've changed it to career technical education, but that is something that we've always desired for our students, knowing that that's an important piece of their education. Failed many times over trying to find the proper place, the proper, the vocation to be able to come in. All of a sudden, my ex-board member told me through a magazine that he read that Salem, Oregon had an outstanding program. I went and visited them. Had Mr. Mattson come as a consultant to see what we're doing. And after a fly fishing trip, and after then coming to see our building, my board president offered him a job. Didn't talk to me, but offered them a job. So the negotiation began. But we had an abandoned building. The recession hit us hard, and our old building that we used to be, K-12 building, moved to a junior-senior high. Now was a place for cheerleaders to work out. At least we had room for them to be here. And then all of a sudden, I brought Mr. Mattson, and we had industries starting to come in. We built a garage door to be able to move things in. We started moving the cheerleaders' mats out. By the way, never try and move cheerleaders out unless you have a place for them to go. And we had to make this 2,500-square-foot facility, or at least as part of a building, into a lean manufacturing woods place. So as you can see, we're starting to move equipment in. And I'm going through it quickly, 18-foot high, bringing students in. What we were able to do at Peyton, and as soon as I'll get to this picture, what we were able to do is that we hired Mr. Mattson in January. We sent a letter out to the manufacturers because of who Mr. Mattson was and what his vision was of woods industry, woods manufacturing. The first day that Mr. Mattson showed up to the job, we had a letter from Stiles. Stiles Machinery is under Dewar, but still it's a $3.3 billion company. And they offered us to say, we would like to talk to you about a partnership. We flew out to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and basically this is the start of it. I will mention the National Training Center here in a minute, but we now have an agreement with Stiles Machinery that once we build the National Training Center, they are going to give their in-kind donation of $2.2 million worth of machinery, high-end CNC technology, for our students to be able to use. Now, granted, we only have 600 students in our school, so I'll get to that as well. But anyway, this is Mr. Steve Waltman, the gentleman with the white hair. He is the gentleman from Stiles. He came out. Mr. Mattson is on my right. I even have a pointer. There's Mr. Mattson. And these students are one of our first students to be able to start going through the program. So this is a letter in their hand right here that comes up to the agreement over a $2 million in-kind donation of where we want to go. So this is, we have now moved our school from the old middle school, as we would call in Peyton, to a career technical education facility. In your packet, you'll see a large amount of paperwork. But not only do we have now our woods manufacturing, we actually even have a Rycon lathe lab. Because of the agreements of our manufacturers, we could not have Rycon in the same room as Ironwood and Time Savers. So we created an extra room because all this equipment that you see here, 8 lathes, a bandsaw, a construction size lathe, dust collectors, that we could not have them in the same room. So right here you're looking at approximately $75,000 to $80,000 of equipment that we had to pay the shipping for. So I thought it was a fairly decent deal. Part of our program and what we're trying to do is we want to get sophomores, freshmen and sophomores. At the end of your sophomore year, the six high achieving children get a scholarship to be able to go to Stevensville, Montana, and help build chairs. These students will build these chairs, Chidwick chairs. Now, this is not an easy task. Once you have curved backs and tapered legs, this is not an easy task. But because of scholarships, students will be able to go. These were the first students. These are from Salem High School. We've only been in really class one semester at Peyton so far. But these students from North Salem High School, basically, they are 78% free and reduced, 28% homeless. A little bit different than Peyton, but still, this is the first class. These are the types of things that they will make. And it's a one-week class that they're able to go to. So it's quite intensive. So in your packet, you will see this piece of article. It is our way of saying this is how our career technical education facility will help students in CTE be able to achieve the workforce or college, because we still want to encourage our kids. If you go at least 2 years, We want four, but if you at least go 2 years for a wood manufacturing, you can go directly to the workforce if that's what you choose. The students will be prepared. I'll tell you about our WCA passport certification in a second. If not, if you go the first 2 years here into manufacturing, once we get to our national training center, students will be able to take the next 2 years in our national training center. It will have an articulation with either Pikes Peak Community College or with Red Rocks Community College. Right now, Woods has to go through Red Rocks. Is that they can get dual credit, concurrent enrollment, and the articulation to where they want to purchase credits later on. So Red Rocks and Pikes Peak Community College. So that's a direction students can go during high school or immediately after high school. Then they have that option. They can go down to the workforce immediately afterwards. They will certainly be ready. Or they can go directly over into a college area. They can continue at Red Rocks, Pike Peak. CSU Pueblo right now we're talking to about engineering. And you'll see a sheet later on that talks about our pre-engineering classes. Oregon State University is building a $60 million wing that matches what we're doing because of who Mr. Mattson is and what they're doing. So Oregon State University has already promised us scholarships for any of our students who graduate from Peyton in the Woods Manufacturing Program to go directly to Oregon State. We also have Pittsburgh State out of Kansas. We have talked to them because of the proximity. Pittsburgh State, whether it's automotive, Woods, or some other courses, that they will take 2+2. In other words, they will take the 2 years from Red Rocks Community College or Pikes Peak Community College, and as we work out those credits, they will be able to go directly to Pittsburgh State, and they'll accept those credits. We are now talking to Western State with Gay, and I can't remember her last name, but we're talking to Western State, and they said they like what Pittsburgh State is doing. They want to do the same thing. Then down over here, because part of the issue, and I guess if we can go to the next slide, please, is that me? Great. Great job. Okay, so I screwed up. That's okay. I can come. I got a back button, don't I? But I missed something. Anyways, I can go ahead and talk without pictures. So what we're trying to do is that on that the sheet that you saw about on February 5th, we are opening up. Thank you very much. On February 5th, we're opening up to our students. We'll be able to go and listen to what we have to say, but what we're doing is we're working with other districts in the El Paso County area. Right now, Whitefield and I, and we're probably about 45 minutes apart. Whitefields are sending students to our program because they want to be part of the national training program so that they have first rights. But we're showing them all the different courses on the back of this sheet. All the different courses that we're going to be teaching at our career technical education facility. So we're talking about robotics. We're talking about automotive. We're talking about potential construction. We're also talking about pre-engineering, and then there's down on the bottom computer applications, and that's expanding as we speak. Friday, we're going to DePew Synthes, which is the titanium rod people out of Monument. They have over 800 employees. We're talking about potentially opening a metals piece within our building as well. So what we're trying to do is facilitate to where we are offering to other schools that they can send their students to our program. Mm-hmm. It's going to be very hard to duplicate just because of the finances alone. The building that we filled with Woods Manufacturing, tell me if I hit the 10 minutes, isn't there supposed to be a buzzer? That was over $500,000 worth of in-kind donations that is in that building. And manufacturers can't recreate that. So we're trying to say we're offering it up to these students that they want to come. Whitefield, Scott Campbell, and I are talking about putting internet on the bus so students can be taking online courses as they're on the bus moving over to our school, as well as District 20. And D49 is only 9-10 miles away so that we can do that without the bus. So then on the backside of my three ways to get to the workforce, on the backside, I have about the National Training Center. The National Training Center is the glorified on steroids manufacturing building that we're trying to find near an airport, because what we will be doing is we're going to be working with so many different groups. Not only are we going to be working with the high school and colleges as we're trying to get these students into the high CNC technology. If a student goes, basically after graduation, We have been told by manufacturers $50,000 compensation job straight off the platform if they want. If they stay with our program, now you're looking at $75,000 just because you know how to run a computer, pneumatic, whatever that other C word right now. That's $75,000 if you know how to run it. But we're going beyond, and we're going to be able to teach them how to use the how to be able to develop the applications and how to fix. So that's part of what we're doing here. But also in the middle, we're going to be working with manufacturers because they need the employees. We can teach the manufacturers the courses they need to have these machines. We're going to be talking to the businesses that want to sell it. Those salesmen need to come, and we will train them so that they understand what the machine is about. And then also the employers, any employers that need it, can come to us, and we will be able to teach and train them. Finally, we also have the college courses, because to be able to have CTE teachers, you have to CTE students, you have to have the teachers that can teach the CTE. So that's where Western State and I are working right now to be able to, whether it's an endorsement on their educational certificate or whether it's CTE certified to where they can have the courses needed or adult education classes. But also, finally, we're working with the military for the GI Bill and Yellow Ribbon program.
That's
so that's what we're trying to do out in Peyton with 600 students.
You are busy.
Questions?
Oh, if I can just, I'd apologize.
Go right ahead.
You will, on your, you can see the Denver Post article that was written on what we're doing in Peyton. On the inside, page 3, on the right side, you will see 39 different manufacturers. Those in red basically are our exclusive partners. And those partners that wherever we took this program, because there are so many abandoned school buildings out there, that these manufacturers say that if you take this program to other states, other facilities, that they have first right of refusals, that they can put their machinery inside that. So it's just another thing to where these companies are all in, and we have companies waiting on the list to where, let's say that Time Savers did not want to go to Grand Rapids, Michigan because of where Stiles is, then SMC Corporation is ready to jump on. Those are the things that we're trying to do and through what career technical education has allowed us.
Awesome.
Very good.
Terrific. Thank you.
Any questions or anything from members? Thank you very much.
No, thank
very
you.
Impressive.
Wow.
Okay, we'll see. Elizabeth?
Mr. Chair, we have some outside presenters for 19.01. So.
All right, why don't we proceed out of order for 19.01. Alternative Education Campus Accountability Work Recommendations. Commissioner, if you'd like to introduce this program.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you know, we have a number of campuses across our state that seek to serve students who may have been out of school for a while, bring some other issues to that, and who are returning to school, typically. And they're part of our accountability system. But what we do have is some modifications of that system to account for the needs of this particular group of students. And under statute requirements, we've been reviewing accountability and accreditation system for those schools. And we're excited to, we provided a report to the legislature, and we're excited to share that with you as well. I'm going to turn it over to Alyssa Pearson to introduce this item. But we're very excited to have these folks with us.
Thanks. Thank you. Good afternoon. So like Dr. Ask said, we've sent you all a report from the work group. They were required by statute to meet and provide recommendations on some aspects of alternative education campus accountability. But we know that those reports are hard to get through, so we wanted to just give you a brief overview with the committee members to kind of talk about the overview of what was in the report. Some of the recommendations in there have to do with state statute. Some have to do with CDE policy, just how we do calculations. They're detail in the weeds things, and we're going to give you a quick overview about what some of those are, but don't worry about the details. We just didn't want to leave anything out. But there is one major recommendation that does affect State Board of Education rules, so we want to make sure we talk about that today and let you all hear that, because that will be an area that you'll want to decide if you want to go forward with rulemaking process, if it's something you want to do. We don't have anything that we have to do today on it at all. Today is really just for information to share the recommendations with you and let you all start hearing those things, especially on that one recommendation that is part of State Board of Education rule. We want to look deeper into ESSA and see the overlap with there and make sure we're integrating and aligning as well, so we want to take some time to do that, but we want you to hear all the recommendations today. So the committee members and some CDE staff members that were part of and helped staff the committee will talk to you today. We're really grateful for all the time. This was a really quick turnaround. You know, the bill passed in right at the end of session. The work group had to get named, convened in July, get going, and their report was due by December 1st. And when you've got a lot of stakeholders with a lot of different opinions that they feel very strongly about their opinions, it was a lot of hard work that everybody did to come together to come to recommendations with consensus. So I'm going to turn it over to Jessica Nevels today, who works in the accountability team at CDE. She's going to start us off. We also have Lynette Steinhoff from CDE here, Carol Eaton from the Jefferson County School District, and Marty Schneider, who's the principal at Community Prep High School in Colorado Springs. So with that, I'll turn that over.
Ms. Nevels?
Hi. Just before I get started, I wanted to talk a little bit about just what alternative education campuses are in Colorado. So currently, 16,000 students attend one of 86 alternative education campuses across 45 different districts. Alternative education campuses are known informally as AECs. You'll hear that term mentioned a few times throughout this presentation. So AECs serve more than 95% of students with an IEP, which is an individualized education program, or meet the definition of a high-risk student, or serve students who serve on a part-time basis. And now I'll just go briefly into what the work group was doing over the past few months. So per House Bill 15-1350, CD was required to form a group of stakeholders from the AEC community to gather feedback on the next iteration of AEC accountability, specifically the school performance framework. CD gathered recommendations of candidates, and the commissioner selected members of the work group from across the AEC community to represent the diversity of AECs in Colorado. The members of the work group are listed on this slide and include staff from districts, schools, CD, as well as parents, students, and representatives from organizations across the AEC community. So the work group met once per month beginning in July 2015 and concluded in November 2015. And by December 1st, the work group was tasked with providing written recommendations to the commissioner, the education committees of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the State Board of Education. And I'll go over those recommendations briefly on the next slide. So the work group members here today will go into detail on the areas specified by statute with the recommendations for the next iteration of the AEC school performance framework, but I'll just go briefly over what the tasks were here. The first was to review the qualitative and quantitative measures of a school's performance in serving high-risk students. The second was development of measure-specific cut points. The third was consideration of the N weighting system and suggestions of changes to weights on the Alternative Education Campus School Performance Framework. The fourth was identification of possible methods and costs associated with using a comparison group to analyze data to compare high-risk students across schools. And the fifth was consideration of the 95% threshold for designation of an AEC, the students included in the 95% threshold, and the documentation and verification requirements for identifying that the threshold has been met. So that, I hope that was a brief introduction there, and now I'll turn it over to Marty Schneider from Community Prep in Colorado Springs to talk through the first recommendation.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. It looks like you've had quite a day just from your faces. Let me share briefly a little about my day. At about 8:45 this morning, a young man, one of our students, came into our building, and as per our procedure, let's just call him Timothy. Timothy comes in, checks in with his student advocate, makes a plan of how he's going to go about his day, and reiterates his academic goals for the day, the week, and the month, and gets started. Within minutes, Timothy walks into our assistant director's office, proceeds to pass out, and begins to shake violently on the floor of our AD's office. And so I'm an EMT, and we have a paramedic on staff as well. So we treat until the paramedics arrive. Timothy's thankfully okay, taken to the hospital. And as we suspected, unfortunately, he had partaken of a substance on the way to school that did not agree with him physiologically. The reason I share that story is AEC is our school's full of Timothys. And so the response that we have and the response that AECs have to build a support system around these kids with equal parts support and accountability to be able to educate them, but also at the same time to help them turn around their lives is really what this is all about in these 86 schools. It's very much a human endeavor. Where that fits into the SPF and the creation of this category of opportunity measures really comes down to you get what you measure, and thus the work of AECs involves so much within infrastructure and support to be able to take care of our kids, to get them to a point where the academic measures, student engagement measures, and workforce readiness measures come to fruition. In our world, that work is expansive and long-term, and you don't see the results right away. And the investment in that work is what really solid AECs are doing. So then, with a measurement system, with our proposal, I'm just trying to give you the rationale and the thinking behind this, with a measurement system that supports those processes that AECs are doing, that holds us accountable to build things in place like drug education and treatment, that enables us to put our resources into the supports more than traditional schools have to, quite honestly, is something that really, really matters. It's a game changer. And so with schools with this profile, having this whole side of things on infrastructure and inputs, that measurement system to be able to account for that, while it's not what we've had in the past, simply measuring student outcomes, it's in addition to that. That is going to make an enormous difference in student outcomes, I believe, because it incentivizes, it nudges, it pushes AECs to build those supports in place that long-term pay off for these kids. Some of the details. We worked long and hard on this matrix, on if there's going to be an opportunity category, a qualitative measures category, where should it fall and what should go away and what should stay and how that should work. How this is settled isn't really the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is to put in opportunity measures. This can be worked with, and there was a lot of talk about what percents and where to take things from. But what's really important here is that we are giving AECs this push to build this strong infrastructure to take care of this really unique population of kids that have failed out of every other opportunity. And so what our group recommended is in front of you. That's step one, and that's hope for implementation as soon as possible. Step two, next slide, is longer term to be able to create a system that's nuanced and sophisticated and keeps growing. What our group recommended was a pilot project of a school review team with experts in this field working with AECs to be able to build these opportunity measures and to be able to be on site and help schools grow in these areas. So that's the longer term vision for this. Stage one is to create this new category. Stage two is to create the pilot working group that enables AECs to grow on site and gives us information as well to move forward. So that's kind of, in a very brief nutshell, where we're at on the opportunity measure side.
Thanks, Marty. Dr. Carol Eaton will talk about the next three recommendations.
So the next three recommendations are the dry data pieces of the measurement outside of the stories of students. But specifically, recommendation number two concerns measure-specific cut points. So essentially, it addresses the question of how to determine performance levels to understand if an alternative education campus has been successful in educating and preparing its students for the next step and also meeting expectations for state and district accountability. The AEC workgroup agreed that the development of cut points should be guided by comparable data that allows for analysis of similar students and schools across the state and, if available, across the nation. Some normed AEC data does exist and it is available, but many measures have not been normed to that specific population. It hasn't been collected or analyzed or normed. So to that end, the AEC workgroup created decision trees, and those are included as Appendix G of the document. And those two decision trees help in the process of developing cut points for how to norm those measures for AEC populations. Those decision trees came out of the AEC workgroup, and they're a step in the direction of how we would norm that across the state and have some consistency. Recommendation two also includes the adoption of a guidance document, and that's Appendix H. And that provides transparency, consistency, and clarity on how to set cut points for data sources used to evaluate AECs. So these two, for this recommendation number two, the estimated resources needed for this work includes approximately $50,000 for an independent consultant to review assessments, analyze the assessment data, and develop guidance documents for cut points for the current measure. So moving to the next recommendation, recommendation number three, this one specifically changes the way that the measures are weighted for AEC accountability. So under the current system, the AEC performance framework measures all sub-indicators the same way. So regardless of the count of students that are included in a measure, they're weighted equally. What this change would be, for example, right now, if AECs typically have more 11th and 12th grade students than they do 9th and 10th grade students, but if a state measure is 9th and 10th grade students, that measure for a handful of students in that AEC would receive the same weight as it would for a measure of 11th grade students that is the majority, the vast majority of the population. So what this recommendation says is that, and the AEC workgroup unanimously recommended this recommendation, is that it would base indicators on the proportion of students in the representative of the population for the school. So it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. It needs to represent the proportion of students that are in the school. And this impact on resources it could be absorbed to existing resources. And then the final recommendation I'm going to talk about is recommendation number four. And this recommendation seeks to develop an approach to develop that comparison group to support the norming of AEC measures. So by comparing an AEC student's performance before they arrive at the AEC and then looking at their performance after they arrive at the AEC, you'd be able to contribute to an understanding of what the impact of attending that AEC is for that student. The recommendation would require an independent contractor to design and analyze that data at approximately a $25,000 cost. So recommendations two through four are all CDE policy changes that do not require state board action, but we will move on to recommendation number five.
Thank you, Carol.
Good afternoon. How are y'all doing today? The last section that I'm going to talk about is the consideration of the 95% threshold for the designation of the AEC campus, and then the documentation and verification that goes along with certifying that those thresholds have been met. The first recommendation, there's two statutory recommendations and one policy recommendation with this last one. The first recommendation is that the 95% threshold be lowered to 90%. So that would be 90% of the school or the applying AEC would be considered at risk or high risk. There was a lot of consideration around this, a lot of conversation about whether or not this would show an increase in the amount of AECs that Colorado has. And given the research that we did with several other states, we determined that there would only be a slight increase of those applying for an AEC status, and that's applying only, not necessarily be receiving the AEC status. The second recommendation that we have are some definitions in what a high-risk or an at-risk student is. So I'm just going to read through those very quickly. So again, amend statute 22.7-604.5-1.5B to add the definitions as B has dropped out of school or has missed more than 4 days of school in a single month, excused or unexcused, or more than 10 days in a school year, excused and unexcused, pursuant with CRS 22-33-107. Has a documented history of child abuse or neglect, has been awarded of the court, or has been involved in the foster care system. Has a parent or guardian in prison or on parole or probation, or has experienced the loss of an immediate family member. Documented history of mental and or behavioral health issue, or has experienced significant trauma. And the last one is a 10th through 12th grade student that is one or more years behind in credits required for graduation based on anticipated year of graduation. This could be an overall credit or in core content credits as determined by the school district or charter school institute, or is a 6th through 9th grade student that has received D's or F's or the equivalent of, we said, in 60% or more of their core subject areas in the 12 months prior to enrolling in his or her public alternative education campus. The rationale, again, behind the first one was that under the original legislation, the 95% didn't show a rigorous SPF for the AECs to have to maintain, and now that we have the SPFs in place, the 90% would then meet the needs of the current AECs as far as accountability. The rationale behind number two is that the current practices to expand the number of students to include those five high-risk categories, and it also provides a very explicit inclusion of other criteria that may put a student at high risk. We did consider the fact that this might increase the number of students, but we felt like there was a lot more continuity and consistency in the language of the definitions that we provided in the revisions. And this would be is absorbed in the existing resources, so there would be no additional resources for that. The final recommendation, as far as considerations, the rationale behind that is that we're looking at... Oh, I didn't go through those, did I? Let me go through those for you. So the last one is a policy change. There we go. Last one is a policy change in looking at how CDE provides guidance and policy documents to the AECs, and looked at defining school district and CDE responsibilities and authority for gathering and reporting student background information related to enrollment, attendance, grades, et cetera, from the previous district, looking at permissible practices for collecting and storing high-risk data at the school, district, and state levels. Also guiding principles for the transfer of data back and forth between schools and districts that is often a struggle with our current AECs returning back to their regular high schools or middle schools. And then the common triggers for an audit of student-level data, high risk and common protocols for the audits based on severity of the triggers. So that's a policy change that CDE would put in place. And the rationale behind that was looking at the current best practices on how the data collection for students at risk and the manner of balancing student and family privacy with the needs to ensure that the AEC statute is being upheld. Alyssa?
So we just wanted to kind of give you that overview. I know some of that was very much in the details for you all. So like I said, next steps, we're going to look in the parts that are about CDE policy. We'll work with our new leadership to make those decisions about going forward. And if you all would like to discuss any of those end weighting, measure specific cut points. We can do that further. We'll talk some more about cut points either later today or tomorrow in that other presentation, too, for the regular frameworks, and we can talk about how those two pieces align. We also want to work on the integration with ESSA and figuring out those pieces. The other point I didn't mention at the beginning, but in terms of the school quality reviews, I think you all heard in December how the SCAP project, the Student-Centered Accountability Project, is working on those school quality reviews, too. So we want to bring those groups together. AECs are a little bit different. The qualitative factors that you may be looking for during a school quality review for an AEC may be slightly different. I think there'll be a lot of overlap, but there may be some additions. But I think we could do a lot of leveraging of that work together, since both those groups have a lot of interest in figuring out how a process like that could work for accountability. So we'll work on that, and then if you all have direction, if there's things that you would like us to look at or investigate, please let us know to go deeper into this report, anything you want us to bring back to you.
Dr. Schroeder.
So, first of all, I'm trying to figure out why we're talking about this. Are all our AECs on turnaround or priority? I mean, this looks like we're lowering expectations for very hard-to-serve kids. How is this better for these students? What is about this that convinced me that especially lowering the academic expectations is a good thing for kids?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think those are really good questions to ask. I think that my understanding of where the recommendations from where the group was coming from was really to try and get at a accountability framework that represented what their missions were and what they were trying to do for students. In terms of those weightings on the framework, that is something that is up to the State Board of Education. That is at your discretion. So that was a recommendation that came from the work group, but that's something that I think we all, you all especially, should have that discussion and think about where you want those weightings to be. I think we may want to have that at the same time as we talk about the weightings for the traditional frameworks, too, and thinking about that with the ESSA changes as well. Could do some alignment there.
So fundamentally, I think our accountability system is designed to measure what's happening for kids. And when we talk about opportunity measures, I want to make sure that's about kids, not about what adults are doing. And I know adults are doing everything they possibly can for kids, but that's not the measure. The measure is what happens for kids. And the measure is once they get out, Do they have opportunities? And I think when we lower academic achievement expectations, I worry that we're not preparing them for once they get out that they can actually do the things they want to do. So I'm a little concerned about this. One, that it's not as students, that it may be less student-centric than I want to see. Mm-hmm. And two, that academics here are just 30% of the accountability piece. I'm all for not over-testing and over-counting on what the tests say, but as a taxpayer, that's number one, two, and three. And so I have some worries I'm not hearing that piece of it. I don't know about 90%, 95%. I imagine the 90%, those are kids that are as much in need as 95%, so that doesn't worry. But some of these other things are, again, kind of the same things. Are we focusing on outcomes for students versus what are the inputs? So those are my comments.
Dr. Asp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great question to Dr. Schroeder. What's really interesting about this, and we heard it in your description, principal's description earlier, is these are kids who are trying to pull their lives back together. Some of the way in which we measure academic achievement has no meaning to them whatsoever when they first do this. Taking a state test is, so I hear your perspective. It's this tension between, are we helping these kids come back together, but is there an outcome for them that prepares them to go off and have some options in their lives and be able to contribute meaningfully? So I know that these folks discuss that tension a lot, and it'll be worth having that discussion about where these weights ought to be. If we have relevant measures of academic achievement, that would cause me to want to up that weight more than if it's an assessment that may not have a lot of meaning to these students. So thank you for the question. Yeah.
Yes. Ms. Masnick?
Would you, is it a fair statement to say that students at AECs have generally, they have come to you from a failed experience for a variety of reasons at brick-and-mortar schools or other schools they have been to? Most students don't elect to attend an alternative education campus as just a matter of choice.
That is correct. And I'd even go as far as to say, and the data backs this, multiple failed school experiences by the time a student reaches an AEC is our norm. And ma'am, if I could address your concerns as well. I don't think I could really convince you of anything for right now, and I totally understand that. The concerns you brought up were vetted every month as our group met, both in a large and small group, and so you make very valid points. I think maybe the best way to get us on the same page on this, I'd like you to come see our school and spend a little time with us and experience it. If you ever had the opportunity, consider that an open invitation. And seeing firsthand the work that we do and then being able to dialogue, I think might be instructive. I think one other kind of touch point, and I got this several years ago from we brought in a consultant just to help us with our systems and get a little better as we do regularly. And after a couple days, he spoke for his team, and he said, "You know what you guys are? You are a crockpot in a microwave world." And I think that, I've never forgotten that, obviously, but I think that sort of describes the disconnect between we want to reach these outcome measures in the worst way, but the lag and the work and the effort it takes to get there, the systems to be able to reach those, is really, you talk to any AEC leader, they'll tell you the daily grind or the work that we do is somewhat dissimilar to what's reflected on those measures. And it just has to be. And so that investment, that's what we're asking, a little bit on input, 20%. That's where this is coming from. So I hope that helps a little, and I'd love to buy you coffee and have you meet some of our students, ma'am.
Thank you. You know, I've served on my local board, so I have had that opportunity. But I have also seen phenomenal outcomes for those kids. And there wasn't, in the few schools that I did visit, the emphasis on not the test per se, but for demonstrating academic success, those pressures were huge. And I think because the kids were, they're kind of enveloped with all the supports that you guys do provide, they wanted to perform, and they did. And so that's why I don't want that pressure to go away. And I'm not saying it needs to be a park test, but I am suggesting that there are some demonstrations that these kids have achieved. I do have some idea what you all are doing to provide that envelope and that nest, and I don't know, cocoon for these kids. I get that part because that's essential for them because they have really, really struggled. But they are just as smart and just as capable. They just have to demonstrate it in a different way. And so I'd rather have you working on that 40, 50%, whatever that was, in another way for them to be able to demonstrate that they can get out there and be ready than I am about taking that away. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay? So I don't want you to misunderstand that I'm all for the park exam or that I don't know what you all are doing because I've had that opportunity, and it is truly wonderful. Thank you.
One quick question. Was one of the recommendations that you change how you are evaluating growth? Was it a student when they enter versus a student a year later? It's currently that you're comparing this year's students against last year's students, correct? Or is that, that's not different?
No,
so you are currently comparing student this year against last year. Straighten me out here.
Yes. Yeah, so,
I thought that was different.
The way the AEC school performance framework works, without getting too technical about it, is AECs are, we're looking at performance and growth on the TCAF exam and then would be now PARC, and then are allowed to include additional measures. So we call those local assessments. So if they used Scantron or one of those other vendors, they could use that as well. So there's different ways of looking at growth, specifically with each of those exams. But we would use either the year-to-year growth or within-the-year growth. And given the way that students come into AECs, they may come in 6 to 8 week cycles. We can measure growth a little bit more a smaller analysis in the months of growth rather than a whole year cycle.
So it's or, not and?
It could be, yeah.
It's an individual student's growth is what we look at, but then okay. Aggregated up, that's right, what I'm at saying. The whole school. Yeah.
So but that's not new, this,
that's not
in this
new.
Proposal.
That's how it's, yeah.
Okay.
We've always had that, and we've always had those other additional measures.
Okay.
That they can, if, you know, Mighty School uses Accuplacer, and so that's something that they put in. We work on them with that as another indicator.
Dr. Flores?
I'm interested in life skills because I know the academics, you know, are important, but I think that life skills, such as balancing out a checkbook, being able to know when to say, you know, stop, and have, you know, those things that are so important to live, aspirations, you know, and such. I know probably you were talking about drugs this morning, and I mean just now, and drugs are, it's an addiction. And so, I mean, I don't know if we know what these kids, whether, you know, being able to do an analysis of, I'm trying to think of a book now, you know, is really as important to these kids as, not that art wouldn't be important to them, but as is important to, you know, to other kids, and whether they need to be working on some things that other kids, you know, don't need to be working on. So that they have so much to deal with that I'm thinking they're just trying to kind of survive and make a life maybe after they go through this. That, not that I don't play, I mean, I am downplaying academics right now, but my God, if they have to survive and have survived so much, should we really ask as much as we do of others? I guess is all I'm saying.
Yes, Dr. Chappell?
I'd like to thank you for the presentation. You know, in my experience, I think AECs serve some of the most needy students in the state, and they're associated with multiple risk factors, which you've outlined. And I think the impact of not allowing flexibility is to create a context where you can't continue to serve these students. So I think standardized tests, we know, are not a great measure of student achievement for many of these kids. They're not able to show what they know based on that kind of a measure, and so flexibility is such an important piece of the puzzle as you continue to do this great work. So thank you for doing it. And appreciate the discussion and look forward to working with you to create flexibility necessary for these students to show growth. It's good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other members? Just a couple of quick questions. It's my understanding that this work group was not able to reach consensus on the vast majority of issues. Is that correct or not?
I could speak on that briefly. We were able to reach consensus, but we, in our report, listed considerations for each of the recommendations. So some of the discussion items that came about from the minority of the members of the group.
Well, if there's a minority in the group, then you didn't reach consensus.
So, Go, Marty.
Everyone in that group was on board with every recommendation.
with some consideration. There was no dissenting opinion on any of the five areas at all.
All right. It's, well, seemed to be a victim of some other information, but so would it be fair to say that the traditional education community is generally hostile to your efforts, and that the purpose of this particular legislation was kind of negatively intended toward your endeavor? Is that a fair statement or not?
I'm in over my head on that one, Chairman. I couldn't comment on that accurately.
Anybody? Anybody think the traditional education establishment isn't hostile to AECs?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, are you talking about individual students, or are you talking about the relationships between students?
Well, the amount of money that it takes, the fact that they get treated differently. I mean, I've seen it over the years. Maybe I'm seeing things.
No, I think from what we hear at the department, I think there's a whole host of different relationships between districts and traditional schools and the AECs. I think there's some that are really collaborative. I think there's some that have, that schools on either side have feelings about each other in terms of why kids come or don't come or what goes. So I think it just varies depending on the districts and schools in the state. But I think there definitely are examples of places where the relationship isn't as strong and where there is some hard feelings between the two. But I wouldn't say that happens everywhere. Harold, do you want to add anything?
I would speak in Jefferson County. We really see all students as wanting to be successful in our county. So we know that all students aren't necessarily successful in every school. So we have high schools that appreciate having alternative choices for students if they're not successful in that particular neighborhood school, that they can go to an alternative education campus and perhaps be successful. So I would say I haven't seen that adversarial relationship between when we think about all of our students as wanting to be successful. We want as many opportunities and pathways as we can develop for them.
Yes, Dr. Sheffield.
I mean, I might be misunderstanding the context, but it strikes me that we're in a time of high-stakes assessments, and you're working with some of the most needy, high-risk kids in the state with multiple risk factors, and that kind of an assessment doesn't capture gains for those kids very well. In fact, they're very unmotivated to take those tests. So I think what we're saying, as I understand some of these recommendations are, we're having a discussion about flexibility so that students with the characteristics evidenced by those that you serve have some flexibility in how they show gains. And that makes total sense. I think, Angelica, you indicated that. I mean, to just hold the AECs to the same requirements of these standardized assessments doesn't work. It's not that they can't make academic gains, but we can't assess it the same way, and we have to build in flexibility.
Right. But I don't want to diminish the importance of the academic part. That's what caused me. I'm all for finding some different ways for kids to demonstrate, have more project base. I mean, one of the AECs in my district, all the kids were accepted at any college. It just blew me away considering what those kids came with. Oh, I'm sorry.
So sorry. We're getting tired. So I know that there are phenomenal things that happen to kids who come with great personal needs and challenges, drugs, all the things that you've described. But they were still able to demonstrate that they've got the moxie and that they've got the academic skills in some way. And it does not have to be. I mean, I completely agree with the flexibility piece. I'm more worried about making it less important and having having learning not be a critical part of their healing. There's more to it than just learning. There's a lot of healing, but that still has to be a huge part for me.
Dr. Sheffield, did you have?
And I would agree. My only thought would be, as we know, when students come into a context and they have huge personal issues, as the case that you referenced, I mean, you know, even Bloom's taxonomy suggests that you've got to address the basic needs before you can get to the higher level needs, which is learning an abstract concept or how to write better or whatever. So, I mean, time becomes a huge variable.
It does.
I would say I hate to join the softy crowd, but I think
it's not going to happen.
But realistically speaking, I don't know if this is, you know, my understanding of the reason for the bill that created this was that it was created, done by people generally hostile to your interests. I don't know whether these recommendations make the, at least my cut of, you know, appropriate consideration of the problems that students who are in AECs face. And, you know, if you look, I guess you could have all kinds of measures of success, like, you know, do they show up every day or on a regular basis, and do they show up on time? Some of the things that would make a good employee, if translated, you know, any more an employee can get to work on time is a pretty good plus. So I think the other thing, if you can teach these kids that, you know, their victim card has expired and the ATM isn't going to take it anymore, that they're in a position where they have to start producing, just instilling a few of those kinds of values, I'd probably label a success. And I also happen to agree with Dr. Schroeder that, you know, you can't overlook the academics because they're an essential part of ultimate success. But at least I think I view these schools by and large as the last stop. And if you don't make it work, they're going to be dropouts, and then we'll go deal as a society with the other set of problems that we know are created by students who don't complete. So it's in many cases, I suspect it's money spent unsuccessfully, but and probably someone is going to, certainly above our pay grade, is going to have to decide whether we want to keep taking the risk with those funds. And I, for one, am for not dinging these programs because they don't make the abstract measures on the PARC tests or other things that you need a fairly broad spectrum of measure to judge success. Any other comments or questions? Yes, Ms. Goff.
Is there, I don't know, Dr. Eaton, I'm looking at you because that's where my head kind of has the best familiarity, you know. Is there any overlap? I would think that maybe judging by the nature of our AECs, the schools themselves and their purpose and how they're designed and why, the answer will be no, not really, and I would understand that. But nonetheless, after what we've heard today and we continue to learn about CTE and other alternative approaches and even in some of our, well, certainly in our lots of choice schools and some traditional high schools as well, the options available, there is a change in flexibility and opportunity. I just wondered if there has any, can there be any conversation between AEC communities and like Warren Tech, for example, in Jefferson County, or the it starts with a B in Aurora and Adams County. There are some other vocational technical career geared K-12 schools. So has there been, could there be, maybe you'll need to just tell me what the law allows or doesn't around that, and what are obligations, possibilities?
Sorry, I'm trying to clarify your question. Are you asking if AEC students could attend a Warren Tech situation, or would an AEC be more Warren Tech-like?
Take their services, share in their services, or be on those campuses once in a while? I guess it's pretty much case by case, I would guess.
Right, and I think that's what you see in the AEC population, is it's very unique. I mean, as you look across, we call many schools alternative education campuses, and they have different missions and different purposes for helping students be successful. So we have special education AECs that are, you know, our Rocky Mountain Deaf School, for example. It's a very different mission and very different instructional approach than you would see at, say, a Brady Exploratory. So we have different kinds, which is mostly dropout prevention, bringing students back in who have failed. So I guess what I would say is that opportunity for trade and professional technical would be available in a mission of an AEC, absolutely. And our Warren Tech vocational school would absolutely allow that kind of enrollment of, if a student was interested in taking a class at vocational, they could absolutely go to the the culinary school there and do some work to learn how to be a chef, as well as do their academics at their alternative education campus.
Is there any connection, alliance with, partnering with, for example, the what's our disciplinary, what's our school? I just
which
went
blank. The Warren Tech?
No. Look out, Mountain. What is it? Is
suspended?
What's our? Yeah. What's our? Just lost it. The name of the for suspended students. It's part of the
detention center.
Part of the juvenile
so
justice system.
Ridgeview?
What's the name of it?
Ridgeview Academy? Are you looking?
Well, there,
no,
that's
not
one.
Ridgeview.
There's one in Jefferson
There's
County.
One in Jefferson. Yeah.
I feel really silly right now.
Mount View. Is it Mount View?
Mount View, thank you, yeah. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, if some of those students are, I don't know, I'm just thinking in terms of what flexibility to build up rather than chop away, you know, something that is pertinent to those kids. I don't think anyone here is anti looking at their. I think we all agree that it's more than a score on a day in a classroom or kids. And so whatever is available and possible for them, bringing in some of the other community options and support systems.
And Mount View is a facility, so that would have different jurisdiction and laws governing detainment of students and things like that.
Please don't tell them I couldn't remember their name.
Yes, Dr. Fullers.
We have a school in Denver. I think it's called College View. And they graduate about 100% of the kids. They do some of the things that you're talking about. They go to culinary schools. They go to the community college, and these are tough kids. But they rate it like the 55th school in the country, and it's here. It's one of the, you know, top schools, alternative schools. You know which one I'm talking about? And they do different things. I think we don't want these schools to close. And I don't know. I thought I was hearing that you guys think it's expensive, it's whatever. But, you know, and there are, I remember doing some work for, it was a life skills program that was very expensive. I mean, to train people to go into districts and train people was, I agree, it was very expensive. But I think we can't allow these kids to not succeed at this last juncture. I think what they have left is jail or whatever, just not being able to have any skills at all. And we certainly don't want that. We don't want that at all. So we thank you for what you do.
Any other questions or comments? I agree. Thank you very much, and we appreciate what you do, and wish you every success. All right. Let's see. Elizabeth, do you want to go back to
16.01?
Break.
We haven't sitting.
All right. Let's take a 5-minute break. Thank you.